Well, it's a real honor to be here in Newtown. You often wish that the circumstances under which you got to know of a place would be different, but it doesn't always work out that way in life. And just the thrill of ministry is oftentimes given a punch in the ribs when you realize that there are some sad circumstances that bring about ministry in some settings. I was writing my ministry letter for the last quarter, and I just said the emotions through which you go sometimes are just too many. You cannot pause long enough to either bask in the afterglow of a great moving of God or to process the agony and grief and pain of somewhere else that you have just visited. Your heart sort of moves in a pendular swing. And we feel very, very unworthy to even be standing up here and bringing to you even a semblance of hope. But the only reason we do is because the message that we bring to you is really not our own. It is from him who is greater than all of us and who sees all things. I was at a university recently where there was a lot of hostility. And I said to them, you know, I'm really not coming here to change any minds. I have a hard time changing my own mind, leave alone changing anybody else's mind. I said, but I believe in a God who does change hearts and minds. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, as the years have gone by, I don't even go to most places alone to speak, because I really am doing all I can to move the focus away from individuals and keep the focus on the message and the truth, because it's a very daunting thing to rise up to people's expectations. You tire of that very, very quickly. You know, in your own heart, you battle struggles, you battle the normal challenges of life. And it just happens that God has positioned you in a certain place at a certain time. But as Charles Wesley says, God buries his workmen and his work goes on. And really, it's his work that keeps us here. I'm honored to have two of my colleagues, Michael Ramsden and Dr. Nabil Qureshi, who will be joining me for the Q&A time after I finish. Michael Ramsden is our European director and did his work at the University of Sheffield, where his doctoral work was in international monetary law. And we met nearly 17 or 18 years ago when I had invited him to consider joining the team when he was being offered a professorship elsewhere. I think it was at Leeds or something. And he and his wife, Anne, relatively newlyweds, took the matter to prayer and joined the team. Michael's done a remarkable job and is truly well-traveled and understands tough situations. Dr. Nabil Qureshi is a Pakistani, but an American by birth. He hails from a Muslim background. He's a medical doctor by profession, and he too has recently joined our team. Nabil has picked up a couple of postgraduate degrees in biblical studies, one from Duke and one from Biola, and he's heading now to Oxford University to get his PhD and do his work there. So these are men who are well immersed in theological truths, but well experienced the reality of what we face globally. It's truly an honor for me to be back with Clive and Ruth. He's right. Many, many years have gone by. We were in the 80s together on numerous things. It was the first conference for young leaders. Now we are definitely not the former. I don't know about the latter. And when we first met, we had darker hair. I had hair. Now I'm not even sure that still exists. And then worked with Billy Graham on Amsterdam 83, Amsterdam 86 in 2000. God has used Clive remarkably around the globe, and our friendship goes back many, many years. And now to meet the rest of your team. When they asked me to speak on the subject, why Jesus, and may I just alert you to the fact that this is not based on my book, Why Jesus, The book has a completely different approach. It is going to be, the book deals with the contradistinctive ideas of the Christian faith vis-a-vis Eastern pantheism, especially the teachings of people like Deepak Chopra and so on. It takes on New Age spirituality in an evaluation and understanding and shows the true message and the beautiful message of the person of Jesus Christ. Deepak Chopra wrote a book which was unfortunately a very poorly done book. He called it The Third Jesus. He said the first Jesus is the Jesus we know absolutely nothing about. The second Jesus is the Jesus that has been manufactured by the church. And the third Jesus is the Jesus who ultimately found nirvana and attained moksha or release or whatever it was. That is Deepak Chopra's idea. Not only fallacious, almost pathetic in the way he approaches the subject. So I have responded to that teaching and going back to the pantheistic worldview. I mention all of that to say that I'm going to talk to you tonight about how Jesus so clearly, so precisely, and so truthfully addresses the human scene. You can look at the teachings of Christ from a prophetic viewpoint and take the hundreds of prophecies that came to pass. You could take the teachings of Jesus Christ in the logic of it, in the sagas that have preceded us, and the explanation of various forms of interpreting reality and so on. Or you can take the teachings of Jesus and apply it existentially in your experience and check out the teaching over against your own real knowledge of what life brings to you and me every day. And so that's the one finger of reality that I'm going to look at today and see whether or not he has something to say to you and me in life, whether it is in pleasure or in pain. My brother is a medical doctor in Toronto, Canada. He's a pain management specialist. And I remember when he first told me he was going into pain management, I said sort of tongue in cheek, but in reality I said, you know, Ramesh, all of life is pain management. It's not just when the body falls apart, but how you navigate through the vicissitudes of life, through the agonies of life. How well I remember being in Battambang and in Phnom Penh in 1974, while it was in the thick of the killing fields, and all the trauma that the Cambodian people went through with the millions that were slaughtered at the behest of Pol Pot and all that that ideology represented. I arrived there shortly on the heels of being in Vietnam, which itself had gone through the trauma of that horrendous war. And when you come from a nation where millions have been obliterated, in fact, he would well remember two of my interpreters. One was a Major Tang Chiek, and the other one was the director of the Bible Society, Sun Son. After the Khmer Rouge took over, both of these men who had interpreted for me, Chiek was taken to the French embassy and shot point blank, killed. Sun Son was taken out into the waters, submerged and drowned. I knew people there who paid with their lives. These were my personal friends. These were the two men who took me out for the last dinner I had in Phnom Penh. And the memories may be 40 years old, but the reality is still very real. And I have no doubt they will tell you many more stories. And whatever happened so tragically here 14 months ago hit the wires all over the world. It was one of those moments in life where you can pinpoint exactly where you were when the news first struck. And I want you to know that in many parts of the globe, as I was traveling at that time, people would stop and ask me if I knew anybody from that scene and would offer. I remember one Japanese gentleman in an elevator just put his hand to his heart and say, "We think of them. We think of them." It is just the kind of grief that raises questions deep into the very depths of our soul, but at the same time brings together humanity in ways that possibly never ever come together. Total strangers would come and tell you they were thinking of America and thinking of the tragedy that befell it. And so I just say to you that in the midst of your grief, I hark back to the time the tragedy took place in Columbine in Colorado. And I got a call that very day from somebody there saying, would you be able to come? And I said, let the wounds heal naturally and in time, rather than even trying to touch that wound, which is so fresh. And it was a few months, almost a year later, I went to Littleton, and we had 3 nights and had a packed auditorium there. So also in Virginia Tech, same experience after the shooting there. I had that daunting responsibility of going there several months later and speaking to the university students. I'll never forget, a whole group of the first responders were in the audience, and some of them just came and gave me a big hug afterwards and just expressed their appreciation. If there's any family here with the grief that is direct into yours, we just want to stand with you and tell you, may God, who alone is able to carry you through, carry you moment by moment, one step at a time. You know, the song used to say, I need thee day by day. Then another song came, I need thee every hour, till someone else wrote, moment by moment, I'm kept in his love. May God comfort you and sustain you and carry you through. He alone is big enough to cradle you in his arms. If there's any small role we play in a word spoken in time, just take it as from him, because he is the healer of our wounds. It is the European skeptic Lecky, who in his book, The History of European Morals from Augustus to Charlemagne, that was published in 1969 in a later version, he made this comment. This is a skeptic writing. The character of Jesus has not only been the highest pattern of virtue, but the strongest incentive in its practice, and has exerted so deep an influence that it may be truly said that the simple record of 3 short years of active life has done more to regenerate and soften mankind than all the disquisitions of philosophers and all the exhortations of moralists. Lecky saying that the teachings of Jesus and those 3 short years of active life has done more to regenerate and to soften mankind than all the disquisitions of philosophers and of moralists. Dr. F. F. Bruce, the famed biblical scholar, responding to Lecky's comment, says this: that is a non-Christian, or at least not distinctly Christian, judgment of one sense in which Jesus is not only a historical figure, but also our eternal contemporary. His influence lives on. I recall as a teenager sitting in my living room listening to what was then called Radio Ceylon. Now would have been probably called the voice of the Radio Sri Lanka. I was a young teenager in search of answers. Nobody was giving me the answers to questions that haunted me. And some of you may know my story. I came to know Christ on a bed of suicide. But plagued by questions that in which I was drowning, I remember sitting at the dining room table. My father and mother and 5 of us kids lived in 2 small bedrooms in a home in Delhi, and there was no place to study. So us kids would sit around the dining room table at night, and that's what we would use as our place of study. And I would turn on that radio and keep that volume relatively low because I didn't want my mom and dad in the next room to hear it. But every now and then, this song would come on, narrated by Ed Ames from the famed Ames Brothers. Went this way, and in the background was an Eastern chant, which is what drew my attention. From the canyons of the mind, we wander on and stumble blind, way through the often tangled maze of starless nights and sunless days, hoping for some kind of clue, a road to lead us to the truth. But who will answer? As side by side, 2 people stand, together vowing hand in hand, that love's embedded in their hearts, but soon an empty feeling starts to overwhelm their hollow lives. And if they ask the hows and whys, who will answer? As high upon a lonely ledge, a figure teeters near the edge, while jeering crowds collect below to egg him on with go man go. And none will ask what led him to his private day of doom. And who will answer? As far upon a distant hill, a young man's lying very still. His arms will never hold his child because a bullet running wild has struck him down, and now he cries, my God, oh why, and who will answer? as need the spreading mushroom tree. The world revolves with apathy, while overhead a row of specks roars on, drowned out by discothex. And if the secret button's pressed because one man has been outguessed, who will answer? Is our hope in walnut shells, worn round the neck with temple bells, or deep within some cloistered walls where hooded figures spray in shawls, or high upon some dusty shelves, or in the stars or in ourselves? Who will answer? And the chorus went this way. If the soul is darkened by a fear it cannot name, if the mind is baffled when the rules don't fit the game, who will answer? Who will answer? Who will answer? You know, the amazing thing about that song that stayed with me was this. I was an Indian living in Delhi, haunted by these questions, the voice of an American with an Eastern chant in the background was asking the same questions. And every time that song would come on, I would crank it up a bit and try to write the words down. What fascinated me about that as a youngster was that the experience of a hunger for answer was universal, but the question was phrased very differently to what I had been phrasing it. I'd been asking, what is the answer? The songwriter, he was sharp and said, who will answer? Who will answer this? In John chapter 18, Pilate is standing before Jesus and had the greatest opportunity in history to have the who was the answer, is the answer, giving the answer. And this is the way it goes. He pitched everything that could have divided people, ethnicity, politics, metaphysics, whatever. And this is the way the narrative goes. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Why did he ask him that? Because they were under the heel of the Romans. Immediately, politics and ethnicity came right into that. Jesus very sharply always questioned his questioners so that it would open up the questioner within their own assumptions and determine the entry point of the discussion. See, intent is prior to content. So Jesus says, is that your own idea? Or did others talk to you about me? Pilate is incensed. He said, am I a Jew? It was your people, your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you've done? Jesus said, you know, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place. Ah, you are a king then, said Pilate. Jesus answered, you're right in saying I'm a king. In fact, for this reason I was born and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. Pilate said, what is truth? And walked away. He could not have asked a more profound question. He could not have been more wrong-headed in the way he walked away. How often you and I ask the same question and we walk away. I want you to just measure three or four answers of Jesus in his person, that display to you and me how right he was about reality. The first is this. He describes the human condition most accurately as being a condition of sin and rebellion against the living God. We don't like to hear this. We really don't like to hear this. I remember a media person once interviewing me, and he was trying to bait me into using the word sin so that he could consider the matter closed, that we have nothing new to talk about. It was Malcolm Muggeridge who said it this way, human depravity is at once the most empirically verifiable fact, even as at the same time it is the most intellectually resistant. Human depravity is the most empirically verifiable fact, even at the same time that it is the most intellectually resisted. We know deep inside us what we are capable of. We know all the prevarications, all the manipulations, all the machinations, all the perversions that go on within our minds and our hearts. We know all the things that tempt us and seduce us. We know all the deceptions that we toy with. We know all the lies that we flirt with. We know all the lust that stalks us. We know all the pride that possesses us. And yet we arrogantly stand and say, have you got no other explanation than sin? This is your heart and mine. Blaise Pascal, writing in the 1700s, said it this way. What a chimera then is man. What a novelty. What a monster. What a chaos. What a subject of contradiction. What a prodigy. A judge of all things, feeble worm of the earth. Depository of truth, cloaca of uncertainty and error. The glory and the shame of the universe. One human being can fill another human being's body full of bullets. Another human being in a doctor's hospital can scrub and give everything up possible to rescue that life and give them back the life that someone else was trying to snuff out of them. What a contradiction. What a prodigy. What immense anomalies live within this heart of ours, the glory and the shame of the universe. My own life has many landmarks. Someday I hope to write, possibly as my last work or whatever, the landmarks that I will never forget. And one of those landmarks was visiting the concentration camp of Auschwitz. I'm sure some of you here have seen it. I'd been to concentration camps before, Buchenwald, Dachau, Mauthausen, all of those. But I'd never been to a death camp, and Auschwitz was a death camp. When you walk into Auschwitz, if you're not emotionally prepared for what it is you're going to see, you're going to be stunned and almost wonder whether this actually happened while the rest of humanity just drove on by. Do you know they were obliterating them at Auschwitz at the rate of 12,000 every day? I don't know how many are in this auditorium. 1,000, maybe a little more. I don't know. Times 12. Where the women would be scalped, shaven, and taken in their beleaguered looking condition and slapped against each other's body and told they were going in for a shower. I walked into that room where the spigots were turned on and the gas would just flow, and they would collapse like bags of meat and then put into trucks and taken away. 12,000 every day. And the most painful room to me was the room where the little children had their suitcases, their toothbrushes, their shoes, their dresses, their clothes. Little boys who were castrated by Joseph Mengele, standing shoulder to shoulder, staring into the camera, looking so vacant in their expression. I saw some teenagers storm out of there, unable to continue. It was all I could do to just hold on to my own chest and wonder, how did this ever happen under the watch of the most educated nation of the world at that time? And the words of Hitler rang clear outside. I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of a conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel. You see, sin is a violation of God's purpose. If you take naturalism, that we are nothing more than the random product of time plus matter plus chance, that we are nothing more than physics and chemistry in motion, if that's the way you take it, then life has no intrinsic worth. It only has extrinsic worth conveyed by some state or power or philosophy. But the fact of the matter is, God alone gives to you and me intrinsic, essential worth. You and I, given that value of life right from the beginning. And that's why the Ten Commandments can be summarized in one word, sacredness. You cannot violate the sacredness of another life, the sacredness of somebody's property, the sacredness of time, the sacredness of marriage, the sacredness of relationships, the sacredness of your neighbor's rights and goods and so on. This is given to us by God. the sacredness of life. That's why we hurt when we see such wickedness and evil, because at its core, it's the violation of the sacredness of your life and mine. That's sin. That's evil. That's what the Bible clearly points out to you and to me. And I know, as I've traveled now in ministry for over 40-some years, 42 this year makes 42 years since I began traveling as an itinerant. And I've often stopped in a hotel room at night and thought to myself, if I had no greater accountability than myself, the allurements there are so powerful. The allurements are there. It is only as you realize the devastation of sin. You know, I was speaking once to a couple of the MLB teams. The Braves were playing the Cardinals one day, and they had asked me to come and do their chapel. And I remember as I was talking to them, I said, you know, guys, I really can't talk to you about baseball. I said, you fellows are so gifted. There's a genius in your physique. The fact of the matter is, I can't even see the ball that you guys are able to knock out of a park. I said, that's a fact. So I'm not here to talk to you about baseball. I said, but I want to talk to you about something that I've probably done more than the rest of you. I want to talk to you about how to live your life on the road. They sat up. I finished my talk. One by one, these big, strong guys came and wrapped their arms around me. I thought they'd break my spine in their hugs. One guy didn't leave. He just put his head on my shoulder and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. The game was just a few minutes away. He said, Ravi, I have more money than I ever dreamed I would ever have, but I've lost everything of value that I ever really possessed. He said, the principles you gave today, I wished I'd applied them in my life as a younger ball player. Sin is seductive. Sin is treacherous. Sin is destructive. And here it is what a skeptic says, Hobart Maurer. I want you to hear this, because this is not a theologian talking. This is the president of the American Psychological Association at that time, professor at Harvard, Yale, John, got his PhD from Johns Hopkins, was a skeptic. And ultimately took his own life at the age of 75. But he wrote an article in the American Psychologist that he called Sin, the Lesser of Two Evils. Here was his point. For several decades, we psychologists have looked upon the whole matter of sin and moral accountability as a great incubus and acclaimed our liberation from it as epoch-making. But at length we've discovered to be free in this sense, that is, to have the excuse of being sick rather than being sinful, is also to court the danger of becoming lost. This danger is, I believe, betokened by the widespread interest in existentialism which you are presently witnessing. In becoming amoral, ethically neutral, and free, we have cut the very roots of our being, lost our deepest sense of selfhood and identity, and with neurotics themselves now find ourselves asking, who am I? What is my deepest destiny? What does living really mean? You hear what he said? In losing the notion of sin and calling it sickness, we've lost a definition of who we are. He says, now we're asking ourselves, who am I? What does living really mean? And he quotes the Anna Russell folk song. At three, I had a feeling of ambivalence towards my brothers. So it followed naturally. I poisoned all my lovers. But now I'm happy I have learned the lesson this has taught, that everything I do that's wrong is someone else's fault. You know, in the year 2002, I had major back surgery. It was a triple fusion. I had stenosis and a double herniation. In fact, it was all triggered the very day I had arrived in Littleton, Colorado. I still remember sitting on the sidewalk there, unable to walk. And they had to literally lift me up as that last engagement with the spine was knocking me off my feet. The doctor looked at it, did that triple fusion, bracketed me with two titanium rods, 8 screws bolting me down. The pain with which you lived prior to and immediately after the surgery, with heavy padding on it, And on the third day, as I lay there and the tears running down the side of your face constantly, I didn't want to mess my mind with all kinds of heavy-duty painkillers and all. I was taking only the minimal amount. And as I was lying there on the third day, I called one of the nurses. I said, is there any way I can just turn to my side for a moment? She said, yes, sir, but we have to do it very, very carefully. She said, I'll bring another nurse. We can't touch your body. It's still under such shock and trauma, and the wound is still so fresh. We will use a sheet with which we will lift and gently turn you. You just completely relax your body. We'll get you onto your side, and you may only be able to last 4 or 5 minutes. We'll come back and get you onto your back. I said, thanks so much for doing that. And they got me onto my side. And I could just feel the tremor in the back, and of course the dressing is fresh. That night I wanted to get onto my side again, so I called the nurse. I said, do you mind if a couple of you can just help me onto my side again? She said, well, I'm the only one on duty. I'll be happy to do it for you. I said, no, ma'am. It took two of them, and I know the skill with which they do it. I really don't think one person. She said, I've been in this long enough. I know exactly. I said, please, I'm afraid. The pain is so damn. While I was talking to her, she dug her hands under my back. 12 years ago, I can remember that as clearly as anything. I let out a blood-curdling scream, and here's what she says to me. My goodness, you've had back surgery. She said, I'm awfully sorry. I don't know why. I thought you'd come in for a hip replacement. Fortunately, all our thoughts are not legible at the moment. When I told the surgeon the next morning, he didn't even wait to continue the conversation. He stormed out of there. You know, I had to go back for a fresh set of stitches and the infection and all of that came in. You wrongly diagnose the problem, you do more damage to what is already hurting. You wrongly position your hands, assuming the brokenness is somewhere else, you only increase the disjointedness of your whole being. I tell you, the world needs to wake up to the fact that the cardinal malady within your heart and mine is that we have clenched our fist against God, and we think politics will solve it, education will solve it, all of these things will solve it. In the 20th century, we killed more people in warfare than the previous 19 centuries put together, and we call that modern times. We must understand it. We must understand what the malady is. The heart is desperately wicked. Jesus described it. But the second thing Jesus gave to you and me is the only solution, and that is of grace through forgiveness and redemption. There is no other hope for us in the condition of your heart and mine. Grace through forgiveness and redemption. Hate, anger, all of that actually can destroy the possessor of it more than it does the one against whom those emotions are turned. We all go through that in life. But I want you to know that when the heart is so wrong, when the heart is so maligned, when the heart is so broken, only the Savior can take us and rebuild and reposition and redirect and redeem. You know, when my dad saw me in a hospital bed when I attempted to take my own life, he almost was sorely embarrassed because it would reflect on him. He'd been tough on me for many years. Thankfully, that's not the way the story ended. He'd been tough on me for many years and told me I'd be a total failure in life, and that's what ultimately drove me to my suicide. But I'll never forget my dear brother lying in my bed in Phnom Penh, 1974. with a flashlight in my hand on arrival, reading a letter that my father had written because he wrote it to me and told me to read it when I arrived in Cambodia. It was a letter that, till this day, as I think of the words, my dad begged for forgiveness because he said, "I nearly destroyed you, son. And now as I see what God has done in your life, I am ashamed of my part in this role, but at the same time thrilled with how God builds, rebuilds, redeems, restores, and does things in the worst of situations and the least expected moments." A little over a year ago, I spoke in the most bloody prison in America, the Angola prison in Louisiana. I went with, I was taken by one of my board members who was a friend who works in the prisons, and he took four or five of us, mainly those working with professional athletes. And as I spoke there three times, one of them describing Angola prison said this: "There's 5,300 prisoners here with the deadliest crimes. 85% of them are on life without parole." I walked through death row, 45 of them, and I went through cell by cell, put my hand through those bars and would shake hands with some of them to pray with them. I saw all of them with the Bible in their room, some of them reading R.C. Sproul, some of them reading this theologian, that theologian. One guy brought my book to me and asked me if I would sign it. I had no idea why those boys were there, obviously for some horrific crime. At the end of my talk to them, which was piped into every cell and 700 audience live, I went over to one of the guys who led in worship and I said this to him. I said, "Do you mind me asking you a question?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Are you here for life without parole?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "How do you feel on the inside that you're never going to get out of here? Never going to get out of here?" Strong guy. He looked at me. He said, "Mr. Zacharias, if you knew the kind of man I was and what I did that landed me here, if it took these prison bars for me to find salvation on the inside and find true liberty in here, I'm so much at peace now because I know my Savior and I deserve what I've got to be standing here. Pray for my parents who are outside and think they're free when actually they live in a greater prison than I do." There's a 6'6" guy, George Morris, was a chaplain to the basketball team in Virginia Tech. He was standing next to me walking from cell to cell. And as we saw the Bibles in there, he put his hand over my shoulder and he said, "You know, bro," he said, "if we had more of these Bibles in our schools, we'd need less of them in our prisons here." You know what happened in Angola? You know what happened in Angola? When you were checked in as a prisoner there, you were given a knife to protect yourself. There were blood stains on the ceiling, blood stains on the walls, blood stains on the carpets. And an amply built warden with the girth of a southern sheriff comes and takes over. And he tells the governor, "I'll turn this place around. You allow me to do it my way." Governor says, "Go for it." He put a Bible in every cell, started a Bible college, started theological training, put Bible verses all over the place. It has become one of the safest prisons in America today, and articles are being written all over the place. In fact, the warden told me you can walk through any cell, and you can look at it, and you take the prettiest girl by your side and walk from cell to cell. You won't hear a catcall. You won't hear a whistle. You won't hear any profanity. No profanity is allowed in this prison by either inmate or staff. Redemption, transformation, change. Who does that? My colleagues know this story. And in May, I'm going to Manila. Because a year ago, one of the most famous actors who'd messed his life up outright, I won't even tell you all that he'd gone to do, messed it up to a point, where he tried to commit suicide, and he was a medical doctor by training, but a famous model and actor, came up after I'd spoken at a meeting, gave his life to Christ, traveled with us for months to have his life mentored and changed. In May, he is hosting a dinner personally for over 300 people, including the president of the Philippines, who's coming to attend it, and the theme he's given it is transformation. What change? And so I say to you, Jesus diagnoses your condition, provides for your malady. How did he provide it? On the cross. That's why the songwriter says, what language shall I borrow to thank you, dearest friend, for this thy dying sorrow, thy pity without end. Oh, make me thine forever, and should I fainting be, Lord, let me never, never outlive my love for thee. As I told one of the four founders of Hamas in Ramallah, we were sitting in his home, and I said to him, not far from here is a hill. 5,000 years ago, a man by the name of Abraham went up that hill to offer his son. Do you remember the story? He said, yes. I said, let's not debate which son. Let's just agree, his son. He said, as the axe about to come down, God stops it. Do you remember that? He said, yes. I said, what did God say? He didn't know. I said, God said, stop. I myself will provide. He said, that's right. I said, Sheikh Talal, very close to where you and I are sitting is a hill. It's called Calvary. 2,000 years ago, God kept that promise. And this time, the axe did not stop. Until you and I receive the son God provides, we'll be offering our own sons and daughters on the battlefields of this world for position, power, land, and prestige. He just stared and stared and stared at me. I was part of a delegation. I was in the guest of honor. I was just five along with the former Archbishop of Canterbury. And as we walked out of there, I went over towards my vehicle. He was bidding the Archbishop goodbye, but I noticed he hurried over towards me, twirled me around, and he grabbed me by the shoulders. Then he kissed me on both sides of the face. He said, Mr. Zacharias, you're a good man. I hope you'll come back again someday. Do you know that Christ? Do you know him? The Christ that redeems, that forgives, that transforms, that offers to be your Savior, to save you first from yourself and all else. He describes a human condition. He provides for my malady. Thirdly and quickly, he is my source and sustenance in suffering. This is a difficult theme to talk about in a place that has endured so much. And we show presumption to even think anything could be said. In a small, small way, many of us go through it. In a big way, some have their lot in life, as happened here. In a small way, but a real way, I lost my mother when I was quite young. She had been my only hope. And if it weren't for her, I would never have made it. And when the news came to me that my mother, my dad's words on the phone were, you have to come home, son, your mother is gone. Never forget that. Your mother is gone. And as I flew back, the emotions churning within my heart, yes, it happened in the 70s, and yet 40 years go by, a day doesn't dawn that I don't think of her. 5 years later, I'd lost my dad. I read the biography of Annie Johnston Flint, and it is called The Making of the Beautiful. She was born, Annie Johnston was orphaned very young, raised by a family called the Flint family. Early in life, contracted rheumatoid arthritis. Then became cancerous, and then incontinent, and then blind. Orphaned, cancerous, rheumatoid arthritis, incontinent, blind. She wrote some of the most profound hymns anyone had ever written, and she wrote this: He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added affliction he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials his multiplied peace. When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving has only begun. His love has no limit, his grace has no measure, his power has no boundaries known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. She wrote that cradled by seven pillows because her body was covered from head to toe with sores. Jeremiah Denton, the famed American prisoner of war during Vietnam, wrote a book when hell was in session and the torture he endured. When he came back, he penned these words that he'd written in prison, putting himself in the place of Mary standing in front of the cross, watching her son crucified. She'd been told a sword is going to pierce through your heart, but she had no idea what that meant. Now she's watching her son crucified, the most painful kind of death. And she writes these words, he writes these words in a poem. Her face showed grief, but not despair. Her head, though bowed, had faith to spare. Even now, she could suppose his thorns would somehow yield a rose. Her life with him was full of signs that God writes straight with crooked lines. Dark clouds can hide the rising sun, and all seem lost when all be one. When Jesus came to raise Lazarus, who had died, Jesus wept. He knew he was going to raise him. He knew that. But he fully identified with the grief and the reality of death. And as he calls Lazarus forth, he knew the day would come again where Lazarus would die. But he wept by the side of that grave. And the irony of John chapter 11, as the power of resurrected life is through the instrumentality of Christ, the very next chapter, a woman with her alabaster ointment is anointing him. And he says, "Leave her alone. She's preparing me for my death." Very next chapter. Death is the reality, that painful reality, which moves me to my final thought, describes my condition, provides for my maladies, sustains me in suffering. And here's one thought I want to leave with you. You see, I'm now a grandfather, and you watch your grandchildren in a way you probably never had enough emotional reserve energy when you were raising your own. And you watch these little ones. And one day my daughter asked me, "What's the difference, Dad?" And I said, "Honey, I think this is the way I feel about it. You come with a stock of emotional energy. When your father and mother for the first time, all of that is in worry, in care, in provision, in sleepless nights, in everything. You have the same stock left. When you have your grandchildren, all of the worry, the sleepless nights, everything is the parents. You have all of that with which to enjoy what you have your grandparents for, because you go back home at night, you know." But then I said this to her. I said, "Sweetheart, have you ever thought of something? When the baby is born, it cries. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they came out laughing? Ha, 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 so happy to be here type thing." You see, grief and crying is natural. Smiles and laughter comes with relationship and security. Grief is natural. The first time they smile at you, there's a relationship, a familiarity, a comfort, a certainty. When you know Christ, That smile is what he puts on your face and mine with the relationship and the certainty and the hope, which moves me to my final thought, the resurrection from the dead. Christ conquering the grave. That, to me, gives the surest expression of the fact that there is an eternal perspective and there is a certainty and a hope that can only come when you look through the eyes of the eternal. Only when you look through the eyes of the eternal. When my dad asked me to preach at my mom's funeral, I had a simple question. Dad, you said gone. How can I speak at the funeral? He said, son, get on your knees. She's the one who pointed the scripture to you that changed your life. I want you to speak at it. And the verse that she read to me on my bed of suicide was the verse, because I live, you also shall live, John 14:19. She didn't know it. Somebody brought it into the hospital room to read to me. She'd never read that herself. Because I live, you also shall live. So I got on my knees and I kept thinking, gone, gone, gone. And the Lord stopped me in my thinking and said, gone where? I said, Lord, she's gone home. Home to be with you. Where every child enters in the presence, in the bosom of their Creator. That's home. With all of the travel I've done for years, the most thrilling thing to me is when I know I'm arriving home. If my earthly home brings me that kind of joy, how much more my heavenly home? I just want to leave two thoughts with you in close. Some years ago, I was visiting Delhi. My wife's from Canada. We'll be celebrating 42 years, the same as Ruth and Clive, just a couple months ahead of them. And she said to me, you've talked so much about your grandmother. Let's go and find her grave. I said, we'll never find it. I knew there was only one cemetery in Delhi, but I didn't think I'd ever find it. She said, let's go. So we arrived by cab, and there's a guy sitting there. It's a wintry day. He's got his little homemade beedi, they call it, cigarette, puffing away with a shawl wrapped around him. And I told him, I'm looking for my grandmother's grave, but I don't know where it is. So seeing that I was with a foreign-looking person, he sat me down. And he goes and brings a register like this. He says, when did it happen? I said, I cannot tell you. I can just tell you I was so young. So he starts off from the 50s. And then he comes to 55, and I'm leaning over. He says, sit down, I'll find it, I'll find it. So I kept leaning over. I saw her name, Agnes D. Monicum. I said, that's my grandmother. He gives me the plot number, and I go over. It's buried deep in the soil. So I go and find a gardener, ask him to bring a shovel, and I paid him something. He starts digging and digging and digging. As he lands with marble, he knows he's reached the stone. And he starts using water and clearing it away. And my wife, standing next to me, she grabbed my arm. See, when my mother died, my father said, what verse do you want on her gravestone? I said, the verse she gave me, because I live, you also shall live. So we're digging this gravestone open. All of a sudden, my wife grabs my arm and she says, take a look at the verse. Jesus said, because I live, you also shall live, John 14:19. I was a wee boy. All I remember was burying her. I remember nothing else about that. Somehow it came through to me, the verse on my grandmother's grave, John 14:19. The verse on my mother's grave, John 14:19. Now my life defined by because I live, you also shall live. I am convinced at the end of life that thread will all come together and the pattern will all fit, and you'll see it through his eyes in a way you've never seen it before. A Vietnam veteran wrote this, and I close. Lord God, I have never spoken to you, but now I want to say, how do you do? You see, God, they told me you didn't exist, and like a fool, I believed all this. Last night from a shell hole, I saw your sky. I figured right then they had told me a lie. Had I taken time to see the thing you'd made, I'd have known they weren't calling a spade a spade. I wonder, God, if you'll take my hand. Somehow I feel that you'll understand. Funny I had to come to this hellish place before I had time to see your face. I guess there isn't much more to say, but I'm sure glad, God, I met you today. I guess 0 hour will soon be here, but I'm not afraid since I know you're near. The signal, well, God, I'll have to go. I like you lots. I want you to know. Look now, this will be a horrible fight. Who knows, I may come to your house tonight. Though I wasn't friendly to you before, I wonder, God, if you'd wait at your door. Look, I'm crying. I'm shedding tears. I'll have to go now. Goodbye. Strange now since I met you. I'm not afraid to die. The description of your condition, the provision for your malady, the sustenance in suffering, and the resurrection from the dead that gives you and me hope. That's just a snippet of these truths. And I apply it in this way. Please listen very carefully. Very carefully. In Daniel chapter 8, he is looking into the future. 260 years before Alexander the Great. And he is looking at a he-goat from the west who would trample underfoot all of the nations around, but by his own hands would suddenly be cut short. The life would suddenly end, he says, of a he-goat from the west. That man's kingdom would be divided into four. Those four would blend into two. Those two would emerge into one. And that one then would be brought down by a stone cut out of no human hands. 260 years after that, you see Alexander the Great emerging. With alcoholism, he died in his 20s. His kingdom was divided into four amongst his generals. They came into two, the Ptolemaic and Seleucid Empire. That emerged into one, the Roman Empire. And then the person of Christ, a stone cut out of no man's hand, that ultimately conquered those kingdoms. The God was so specific in kingdoms and prophecies and the future. Are you telling me he doesn't have the power with his own salvation to free you and give you the future back because he controls it, he holds it? This is the God of prophecy. This is the God who knows the future. This is the God who will take you and me through. The Christ of history is the Christ who is our eternal contemporary. He is the Christ who offers to be your Savior. He is the Christ who is the Redeemer. He is the Christ who is the Comforter. He is the Christ who conquered the grave. This is the living Savior. In him alone you can find that eternal hope. There is no one else in history like unto him, not just in ethics, but in the power to change your heart and mine. May God richly bless you as you think of these truths. God bless you. God bless you. God bless you. God bless you.